Welcome to Dakota Midday from South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke, and today we're coming to you from the SDPB studios at the Doll Art Center in Rapid City. Yesterday, the 5th Annual Black Hills Film Festival kicked off a few blocks away from here at the Elks Theater, and events and films continue today in Rapid City, and then tomorrow through Sunday in Hill City. One of the short films showing this afternoon is Ishtima to Rest. That one's set on Pine Ridge and tells the story of a young Lakota man who reconciles with his father while breaking the cycle of trauma in the family. Actor Scott Means and writer-producer Jesse Shortbull join the program later this hour. But first, probably the centerpiece of the Black Hills Film Festival this year is the documentary Dinosaur 13, which was featured last night, and it's getting shown again Saturday afternoon at the Hill City High School. The film is about the legal battles over the ownership of the Tyrannosaurus Rex known as Sue. In the summer of 1990, paleontologist Peter Larson and his team from the Black Hills Institute in Hill City unearthed a T-Rex skeleton in western South Dakota near Faith, and it was the largest, most complete Tyrannosaurus Rex ever found. They nicknamed the dinosaur Sue after Sue Hendrickson, who first discovered the bones. But 2 years later, the Institute was raided by federal agents and the National Guard, and Sue was hauled away from Hill City and eventually auctioned off to the highest bidder. In a court case that followed the battle over Sue, Peter Larson was sentenced to 2 years in prison. Director Todd Miller based Dinosaur 13 on the book Rex Appeal by Peter Larson and his former wife, Kristen Donenstandard. Miller and Donenstandard are with us here in the studio to talk about the film and the story behind it. Todd and Kristen, welcome to Dakota Midday.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
And Kristen, Peter was invited, but unfortunately there was a death in his, one of his colleagues passed away.
Yes, one of the families who has been key in the excavation of all the dinosaurs in this area, the Sackersons. There are two twin brothers, one Steve and one Stan, and both of them have found T-Rexes, which is amazing. And Steve, unfortunately, had cancer and passed away last week. And so Pete and some of the Sackerson family are actually digging his grave today by hand. It's an amazing honor.
Well, I'm sorry to hear about that, and sorry that Pete won't be able to make it here, but you're here and you'll be able to talk about the Dinosaur 13. But Todd, I'd like to start with you. How did you become aware of this story, and why did you want to make a movie about it?
Well, we were making more of an art film about paleontology, more of a general film just on the topic of the science behind it and the people that orbit in that universe. And so we, packed up the truck and we're driving around the country interviewing museum curators, other scientists, paleontologists, etc. And just happened to be reading Peter and Kristen's book, Rex Appeal, while we were on the road. They were the last stop for our interviews, and made it to the Black Hills and Hill City. And I had finished the book a few days before, getting here. And met them and spent some time, in the area for a couple days. And I just immediately was enthralled with not only their book, but also just the beauty of the Black Hills and the area and the people that we met. So we offered to option the book. And, 3 years later, here we are.
Now, you mentioned this was your last stop. So you must have already had an idea for a movie that was then discarded, and you worked on this instead.
Yeah, I mean, we shot a ton, so it was, definitely, getting rid of some really great stuff. Probably my favorite was we actually went down to a dinosaur auction in Texas and shot down there for a couple weeks and had all these really great time-lapse shots of dinosaurs being built and auctioned off and, interviewing scientists and commercial paleontologists. And so that footage ended up being, scrapped for this, and we just went full steam ahead with, Peter's story and Kristen's story.
Yeah, Kristen.
There was an awesome moment, though, in the interview process when Todd and his wife, Laura, were here, and Tom Peterson, the camera guy, the director of photography. But the moment of realization when Todd and Laura recognized the difference of the story that they were going to make and the story that they had started to make. They were changing the battery in the camera, and all of a sudden Laura said, "Oh my God, we've made the wrong movie." And Todd goes, I know, this is it. And it was an amazing moment to watch.
Is that one of the things that happen a lot with documentary filmmakers, that you start making one film and then another film comes out instead?
Yeah, I mean, you know, having a lot of filmmaker friends, I mean, for all intents and purposes, this is our first, you know, feature-length documentary. But I think that's just kind of part of the process of, you know, being an artist, is keeping yourself open to, you know, things that come your way, and then being in, putting yourself in a position to be able to respond to that, and then, you know, ascertain exactly what the, you know, best way to move forward is. And in this case, you know, I think we definitely made the right decision. It was more of a microcosm of the bigger, you know, movie that we were making, but it had all the stuff in it, all the ingredients that we wanted to discuss, and the more artistic film that we were doing.
Well, Kristen, what was it like for you and for Pete and his brother Neil and the other Sue Hendrickson and the others who were involved intimately with this story, to have Todd Miller come in and tell this story? And in some cases, there are some very personal things that are included in this movie.
There are. And basically, it had been one of Pete's and my biggest challenges was to vet the different inquiries we had received over the years. We had many, many companies approach us with a variety of ideas and concepts. And basically, he and I agreed early on that the only way we would agree to ever have any sort of film made about the book or our stories is based on the relationships that we might build with the person in question. And when Todd and Laura were having that conversation about, oh, no, and we could tell that they understood. He had just read the book. He's got an amazing ability to retain detail. He's an excellent researcher. And we could tell that he would do a good job and with integrity and honor, and that was what was the key. So as the interviews progressed, I helped him a lot with just, you know, background and introduced him to people he hadn't already met and all that kind of thing. But everyone was very safe in Todd's hands, and it was instantly evident that he would do a great job and an honest job, and that's all we wanted.
Well, take us back to the story itself. The summer of 1990, Todd Miller. What happened? How was this dinosaur discovered?
Well, they were actually the Black Hills Institute was working a quarry that they had, a dinosaur quarry called the Ruth Mason Quarry, which was outside of Buffalo here in South Dakota, and they were just prospecting. I'm sorry, Faith, South Dakota, not Buffalo. Sorry, Buffalo. they were, it was at the end of the dig season, the summer of 1990. They were doing some prospecting on some ranch lands. And one of the ranch lands was a gentleman by the name of Morris Williams, and also his brother Sharky Williams owned some property too. So they had found, you know, some things, some, you know, Triceratops, T-Rex teeth, that sort of thing. And one morning they woke up, Pete, and noticed there was a flat tire. They had to go get it fixed in town in Faith. And Susan Hendrickson stayed back, and she said, well, while you guys are fixing the tire, I'm just going to, you know, go prospecting. And, you know, a couple hours into a fossil walk, she discovered Sue. And it was on a cliff face on Morris Williams' property. It was about 8 foot up the side of a cliff. And, you know, there were never – the Black Hills Institute had never collected a Tyrannosaurus rex before. So it was a couple miles away from where their camp was. Susan thought they wouldn't believe her that she actually found the T-Rex. So she took a couple bits of – that had weathered out down the cliff face. And she made it back, and Pete looked at it and said, you know – Is there more of this? Like, he just, you know, everyone was speechless. So he and Susan showed him where it was. They actually ran back to the to where it was, and he looked and he said, I think the whole thing's there. There was just a couple. There was three vertebrae that were sticking out, a couple of hip bones, I think maybe a femur. But there was very little that was actually exposed. So, and that's a good sign if you're a paleontologist. So it looked like the whole thing was yet to be discovered, and that's what set it all off.
The problem was, as I think it was Pete Larson said in the film, that the place where they found it was probably the worst place they could find it, just given the legal uncertainty as to who owned the land, who owned the dinosaur. What were some of the, you know, who all owned the land, or who laid claim to that, and what were some of the problems there?
Yeah, I guess I'll field that one. but it was Morris Williams' land was that particular parcel of land was held in trust. He's a quarter Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe member. And that particular land, plot of land was held in trust with the U.S. Department of the Interior through the Bureau of Indian Affairs. So what that really meant was it was really in kind of a gray area with respect to fossils. That really there really hadn't been any legal test or precedent that had been set as to whether this was officially public land, was a private land. Even though Morris Williams, in fact, had to get permission to sell anything through the tribe. So there was this just one of our characters in the film, one of the attorneys says it was Sioux came out of a legal netherworld. So no one really knew exactly what it meant. At the time, there was a transaction that was made. They paid Morris Williams $5,000. The dinosaur was still in the ground at the time. It was a couple days before they removed it from the ground and loaded it on trucks to take it back to the Black Hills Institute. They actually were very weary of trusting Morris Williams, so they actually videotaped him, and he actually said on camera that he was happy that it was going to be mounted back in Hill City. He had actually made a kind of a joking comment that is this the first fully articulated, you know, dinosaur found in South Dakota? And somebody said, well, it's not the first. And he said, well, you're going to take it back to the museum, and underneath that it'll say stolen from Morris Williams. And everybody laughed. So it's not clear, because unfortunately Morris Williams passed away in 2011, what exactly his intentions were. We do have some, you know, folks who have talked to him over the years, and he was interviewed in other media. Whether or not he really intended to sell the dinosaur to Peter Larson and those guys, but it went to a custody battle, you know, after the dinosaur was seized by the federal government in 1992, and a custody battle ensued, and then it came down to attorneys arguing over things like as the arcane Antiquities Act of 1906, which, you know, applies to archaeological remains but not necessarily paleontological remains. So it really was a gray area.
Hey, Kristen?
There's one thing. Since Pete's not here, I know what he would say. And he would say, back in the day when they dug that dinosaur, all that you just described is perfectly accurate, Todd, but it was irrelevant at that moment. It had never entered anyone's mind to question any of this, because what they did at the time was what they always do. They checked at the courthouse. Morris Williams owned the land, held the deed. The deed was in trust with the government, so that it meant that he didn't pay taxes on the land. But nothing they found in those records indicated anything different from any other land ownership. This case set the precedent. This case caused the question to come to light. And it was only because people were fighting over something they thought was valuable. Otherwise, it probably would still just be a non-issue.
Yeah, once the dinosaur was excavated, everybody knew what the cost of it might potentially be or what the worth of it might be. That's when everything really kicked in the high gear.
So why was it 2 years after this that the federal agents came and seized Sioux? Did you get into that in the movie? What the reason
Absolutely.
For that was?
Absolutely. I mean the reason was that it was taken off of federal land without permission. I mean, that was the reasoning on behalf of through the U.S. Attorney's Office, and the reason that they did. And they seized it on behalf of the U.S. government.
And Kristen, that's about the time that you get into the story?
Yes, I was working in Los Angeles at the time at NBC. I was working there, and so during the seizure, they called me. And actually, because Tom Brokaw is a South Dakotan, they thought that probably I would just walk down the hallway and knock on Tom Brokaw's door, and that he would jump on a plane. So that was the level of naivete, too, that was going on, but because Tom and I never met. But yeah, so I came soon after.
All right. You're listening to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and we're talking to director Todd Miller about the new movie Dinosaur 13, which is showing during this week's Black Hills Film Festival in Rapid City and Hill City. Also with us is Kristen Dunnan-Standard, who appears in the film and co-authored the book Rex Appeal about Peter Larson and the Black Hills Institute's battle over Sue and the T-Rex. And we'll talk some more right after a break. Welcome back to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke. Today we're coming to you from the Dahl Arts Center in Rapid City. The 5th Annual Black Hills Film Festival kicked off yesterday in Rapid City. It continues through Sunday with more screenings today at the Elks Theater in Rapid City and then tomorrow through Sunday in Hill City. And one of the films in the festival, Dinosaur 13, tells a story very familiar to people in Hill City and the hills. It's about the Black Hills Institute's battle over the ownership of the T-Rex named Sue, the largest, most complete T-Rex ever discovered. And in that story, 2 years after Peter Larson and his team unearthed the dinosaur, the Institute was raided by federal agents, and the National Guard and Sue was hauled away from Hill City and eventually auctioned off to the highest bidder. And in a court case that followed the battle over Sue, Peter Larson was sentenced to 2 years in prison. The whole story is told in Dinosaur 13. We're talking with the director, Todd Miller, and Kristen Dunnan-Standard is with us as well. She co-wrote the book with Peter Larson. She wrote the book Rex Appeal. And the title, Dinosaur 13, Todd, what does that mean?
Well, prior to 1990, there was only 12 Tyrannosaurus rexes that had ever been discovered, which is really exciting if you think about it. I mean, only 12. So all of us growing up, we only had 12 specimens. Depending on how far back you go, maybe there was only a few. And of those 12 specimens, less than 40% of the actual specimen was recovered. So, you know, for all intents and purposes, we had never found a complete T-Rex. I mean, we didn't know exactly what they looked like. And finding Sue in 1990 was the discovery of, you know, a lifetime for not only people, but it was the first time that we could, you know, see what a T-Rex was. So, and it was the 13th T-Rex that was ever found. So that's where the title comes from.
Now, the film features archival footage. There's some camcorder shots from the discovery and the digging, the early digging. And there's some news footage. Could you have made a documentary without all of that?
Well, it's ironically enough. I mean, our pitch to Peter and to Kristen and the Black Hills was to go out and do first-person narrative interviews, have everybody say their own stories on camera, and then we were going to take it back, edit the footage. We knew how the story was formulated, but when I was reading the book, it was so cinematic. Things were jumping off the page. Little minute details like fog on the prairie, you know, the tents flapping in the wind, a pickaxe and close-up, you know, on rock. I mean, that those little things to a guy like me is like, I can't wait to get out there and film that. So once we started getting into the project, they started turning over footage because they're scientists. That's what they do. They document everything. And I had no idea that all this stuff existed to the extent of what it did. It was high quality things for the time. So stills that were shot on, you know, gorgeous 35mm film that would, you know, that were better than any digital still you could take today. The video footage that we have, yes, it's grainy by today's standards, but back then it was, you know, it was high tech. So every single time we showed up, there would be, you know, they would knock off the dust off of some, you know, VHS tapes, digitize it for us. I would get a hard drive or a disc, and it would just have like these hours and hours and hours of footage. So to the point where even as we were right up to the end of the editing of the film, and Tim Larson, who runs the AV and does a lot of the AV services, photography and video for the Institute, who's Peter Larson's son, was just instrumental. Not only did he do that, I should also mention that he played young Peter Larson in the film, because the one thing we did with once we had this archival footage, and we of course used it, I mean, why wouldn't you, but we also supplemented that with things later in the film, for instance, Peter going to jail, getting out of jail. There were very emotional, very cinematic scenes that we wanted to that obviously no one was there with a video camera, so we wanted to reenact those, and Tim assisted us with that.
No, no, Kristen, we talk about Peter Larson going to jail. You were married at the time. You mm-hmm. and Peter were married at the time, and I'm wondering what was it that led to him being sentenced to prison? Because this came after the Sue situation, and this was not exactly connected to what was going on with the legal battles with Sue. This was something else.
Right. The Sue situation was basically a custody battle. And that battle, that discussion legally, caused the federal government to begin an investigation that was separate from Sue. And in fact, the trial, during the trial, the jurors were surprised that they were not hearing about Sue. The case, the federal court case was not about Sue at all. It was about the question of whether the Institute personnel were collecting fossils illegally, and if they were off of government lands where they did not have permission, and if they were and then selling fossils or conducting regular business, then they would be, if they had a stolen fossil, committing several other crimes like wire fraud and money laundering and things like that. So it was sort of like a RICO drug case the way it was structured. So it was a surprising turn of events for everyone that the case wasn't really about Sue at all. And then Pete's convictions, they were all, the main characters in the story were charged with about 153 or 52, depending on the person, individual counts, either misdemeanors or felonies, depending on the different person. And of all of those, Pete was convicted of two felonies, of a failure to fill out the correct forms when traveling internationally. And so it was pretty surprising, and actually one of the biggest traumas and complaints about the case, that he was sentenced to prison at all. The theoretically, he should have been on probation, but the judge enhanced his sentence as if he had been convicted of other charges by using a different burden of proof than the conviction requires. Though that ability to do that is no longer something you can do in federal court. So Pete would not today have been going to prison, but he was at that time.
What did all of that do to Pete and his brother Neil and everyone at the Black Hills Institute? This whole experience, you know, first of all, the excitement of discovering Sue, then having it taken away, then being sentenced to prison. I mean, the up and downs there. I mean, what happened after all this? I mean, what's going on with Pete and Neil and everyone else? Are they able to then put this all behind them and go on? Or is there still something going on? Is this always a part of what they do?
That's a really good question. It's a traumatic experience you wouldn't wish on anyone, to have this kind of experience. Neil says it well in the movie. They found another T-Rex, Stan, the second most fabulous T-Rex on Earth. And there were just a couple of weeks after they brought Stan home, and the two fossils were there together before Sue was seized. And so Neil says, oh, everything was great. We're in the top of the world. And then all hell broke loose, I think is his quote. And in fact, that's what happens. Everyone just, you know, went into survival mode. It was many years of searches and seizures and court cases and, you know, the trial itself. And then prison for 2 years. And it's something that you can't really imagine unless you go through it, and I wouldn't want anyone to go through it. The company just sort of held its breath, and a lot of people assumed it would go under. And there were some very loyal, amazing clients worldwide who didn't go away and who intentionally purchased giant fossil, you know, jobs from them so that they could stay in business, and really told them, underscored for them the importance that they hold in the industry worldwide, because they are the largest and most successful private fossil company on Earth, and they have achieved that because of their integrity and honor. So they're amazing. And as years go by, you know, people change. There's a lot of scarring left today. There are people who are still very much suffering from what happened. Pete happens to have this sort of childlike ability to move on and to not hold a grudge. He really is happy that Sue is being seen by millions of people. He really isn't angry at the individuals who prosecuted the case. He sees them as having been doing their jobs. And not everyone was able to walk away like he can. And however, everyone's still working. The Institute is still great. It's still the best fossil company in the world. A lot of the kids work there. Neil is now has his own company, a separate paleo company that he's just beginning and is just taking off. So the Larsons will persevere always. They are indomitable, and their spirit remains intact.
And I'd say, just to add to that, you know, this didn't just happen to just the Larsons. And if Pete was here, he would mention this. But it happened to the town, the entire town of Hill City. And it's interesting to, you know, kind of look at it from the perspective, how would the town be different if Sue, you know, remained there? Would it have been different? Because it was such a centerpiece to not only this museum, but, you know, it would have drawn. I mean, it you know, becomes a tourist attraction. So the fact that, you know, this thing was taken from this town, and we have, you know, just talked with so many individuals that were there during the protests, or that was there, there were kids, they're all grown up now, a generation has gone by. And like Kristen said, it's really affected their lives. And we hope that the film gives some sort of closure to that community.
I would say two additional quick things. One, one of the jurors was at the screening last night, and she was describing the fallout, the emotional fallout for all of them and their families. But also, Tim Larson told us at Sundance Film Festival, where this premiered, that watching this movie changed his life. When he was 8 years old, when this was all happening, I remember he looked at me and said, "I just can't feel anything anymore. It's just too hard." And now in his 30s, he sees this movie and he says, "Okay, I can live again."
You're listening to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. We're discussing the movie Dinosaur 13, which is screening at the Black Hills Film Festival, going on this week in Rapid City and Hill City. With us, the director Todd Miller and Kristen Dunnan-Standard, who co-wrote the book Rex Appeal with Peter Larson, her former husband. That's the book on which Dinosaur 13 is based. Todd, I'm wondering about in producing a documentary like this. Earlier, you were talking about the close relationship that you have with the subjects, with the Larsons, with Kristen. Does that create a problem in producing a documentary when you have a close relationship with the people that you're doing a film on? I mean, were you trying to step back, or are you trying to tell their story?
Well, it was very important to, and I had mentioned this to Peter and Kristen, kind of my pitch and telling the story was to be as objective as humanly possible. I know you guys wrote this book, but I really want to go out there and research and investigate things on my own. And talking with people that now, and this is the kind of project where enough time has passed that maybe there's some people that didn't feel comfortable 10 years ago, you know, even 5 years ago, might be comfortable talking now. So that was very important for me. And I said, there might be some stuff you don't like, but I have to, you know, just as a filmmaker, I have to explore that. And they are amazing people in that they allow me to do that, and allow me to go off and find, you know, the story on my own and to check facts. There had been so much stuff written about this. There had been so much media exposure that it was fairly easy to go. And we're dealing with a historical event, so I was able to not only talk with people, but cross-reference stuff. And I would like to say that the facts that are presented in the film, because we were doing a first-person narrative, I always had to have somebody verify it. So we approached it very much not only from a filmmaking cinematic standpoint, but also as an act of journalism to go out and make sure that things that we, you know, were putting in the film were completely vetted, or we had people on camera talking about it and someone else, you know, verified stuff. Because there's a lot of minutiae in the legal stuff. And we had prosecutors that prosecuted the case that were just very gracious with their time. If they couldn't appear on camera, I could always call them to verify a fact. Same thing with the other side, the defense team. And we had several gentlemen on camera. The investigation that took place that led to the criminal trial, I talked with everyone that was involved. And if they couldn't, again, get on camera, they would, you know, want to at least make sure that we got it right. So we would, you know, utilize things like graphics and things like, you know, other, I guess, first person, you know, people talking about it. But that was a very important aspect from a filmmaking standpoint to treat it objective. But I let everyone know that this was Peter Larson's story. We're going to tell it through his eyes. He was going to be the protagonist in the film. And good or bad, however that played out, he was our central character. And then everything else was just filling in the gaps to tell his journey, his story over this 10-year period from 1990 to 2000.
How much of the story is left out? You know, this is a feature film, but you only have so much time to work with. And there's a lot of, as we've talked earlier, the whole legal minutiae regarding land ownership and trusts and reservation land and who owns this and who lends that, what's a mineral, what's land.
You know? It's one of the most frustrating things as a, you know, with a story like this. To tell it in under 2 hours, it's almost impossible. I mean, we said last night during one of the Q&As that this is like the Cliff Notes version. I mean, this could be a 10-part miniseries that you would see on HBO. There's that much stuff in there. So one of the hardest things to do with this film was to look at all the facts, and that's why the book is so great. I mean, I want this to kind of be – the film should be a window if people are interested in exploring, you know, all the gritty details that are involved. And it's an important aspect that, you know, they should read the book, but it's such an important historical thing that happened. That deserves to be documented in this fashion, but also documented in other ways. And the book is a wonderful guide. All the other media are wonderful guides as well.
And for you, Kristen, since you co-wrote Rex Appeal, the book on which the movie is based, are you happy? And also being someone who was involved in part of the story, what are your thoughts on this movie and even seeing yourself up there on the big screen?
Well, first of all, Todd and I have like a sibling relationship, and I really hesitate to say something complimentary when he's sitting here, but he did an amazing job at research, and he really, really did go and find out for himself what was going on. And he used our book as a basis to launch his inquiry, but he did his own job. And since that happened, and we knew he did it in the way he did, we trusted that even if there were some difficult parts, we would live with it. In fact, we really are very happy with the film. We think he did a fair job and a good job. In fact, I also wasn't even supposed to be in the movie. Those little segments where I was explaining stuff to him, he was just saying, tell me how this worked. And I would say it, and he would say, you know, nobody else is telling me this. But I'm the researcher, so like he is. And so I would say, well, this is how I put it together in my mind to make sense to me so I could make it easily understandable. And he said, you just have to be on camera. And I said, no, I don't. Let's find somebody who can do this for you. And finally, he started hitting me with a bat. And I said, okay, I will be on your film if you will stop hitting me. And so
yeah, Kristen's very modest, as you can tell, and completely inarticulate. She was terrible on camera.
I know, right? Sorry.
Bad, very bad decision.
I'm very sorry.
So that's how you get people to talk. I should bring a bat.
Right.
That's
then.
Right.
Right. That's my cinematographer's job, Tom Peterson.
That's really
walks
the only
around
thing.
With
he's
a
with
big
a bat.
Bat. Yeah.
It's the only thing he does well, really, Tom.
Right. Yeah.
Talk. What happens next with this movie, Todd? It was at Sundance. It's got major distributors. What happened? It's here this week, or there's one more showing on
Friday?
Yeah,
so we're showing on Saturday. It was picked up by Lionsgate and CNN in a partnership. Lionsgate is going to be doing the theatrical component, so they'll be releasing it in theaters on August 15th. And then we're happy to say that it's going to be shown here in Rapid City or Hill City and then the Black Hills, which is going to be great. So stay tuned on, you know, where and exactly when, but mid-August. And then CNN is going to broadcast in late November. The international rights were purchased, so it's going to be shown as far away as, you know, Australia, New Zealand, and we have UK theatrical component. There'll be in theaters in Europe, and then a television component as well. And then next year, they're thinking January, February, we'll have a DVD Blu-ray release. And they're also going to release it as a day and date, as they call it. So it'll be released digitally the same time it's in theaters. And in between all that, this summer it'll be appearing at some film festivals that are, you know, just select screenings around the country and internationally. And you can always check more information at dinosaur13movie.com.
Kristen, you had one more word here.
I meant to ask you, is it going to be all over the state or just on the western side of the state?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that.
Okay, yeah, we'll keep you posted.
We'll keep you posted.
All right. Yeah. Well, Todd and Kristen, thanks so much for joining us on Dakota Midday.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Todd Miller is the director of the new film Dinosaur 13. Kristen Dunn and Standard appears in the movie. She also co-wrote Rex Appeal with Peter Larson. She's also the president of the South Dakota Arts Council, or the South Dakotans for the Arts, and the Hill City Arts Council, when I get that right, and co-owner of the Black Hills Browns Fine Art Foundry. Dinosaur 13 shows Saturday afternoon at Hill City High School during the Black Hills Film Festival, and a discussion over the legal issues raised in the film follows that screening. You're listening to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke.